Ah, his smiling eye, thought Victorian.
Crow's eye, he said. King Crow's eye, brother. Euron smiled. His lips looked very dark in the lamplight, bruised and blue.
We shall have no king, but from the king's moot.
The Damfair stood.
No godless man
may sit the sea stone chair, aye.
Euron glanced about the tent.
As it happens, I have oft sat upon the sea stone chair of late. It raises no objections.
His smiling eye was glittering.
Who knows more of gods than I? Horse gods and fire gods, gods made of gold with gemstone eyes, gods carved of cedar wood, gods chiseled into mountains, gods of empty air. I know them all. I've seen their peoples garden them with flowers and shed the blood of goats and bulls and children in their names. And I have heard the prayers in half a hundred tongues. Cure my withered leg, make the maiden love me, grant me a healthy son. Save me, succor me, make me wealthy, protect me from mine enemies, protect me from the darkness, protect me from the crabs inside my belly, from the horse lords, from the slavers, from the sellswords at my door. Protect me from the silence. He laughed. Godless? Why, Aaron, I am the godliest man ever to raise sail. You serve one god, Damfair, but I have served 10,000, from Ib to Asai. When men see my sails, they pray.
The priest raised a bony finger.
They pray to trees and golden idols and goat-headed abominations, false gods.
Just so, said Euron, and for that sin I kill them all. I spill their blood upon the sea and sow their screaming women with my seed. Their little gods cannot stop me so plainly. They are false gods. I am more devout than even you, Aaron. Perhaps it should be you who kneels to me for blessing.
The red oarsman laughed loudly at that, and the others took their lead from him.
Fools, said the priest, fools and thralls and blind men. That is what you are. Do you not see what stands before you?
A king, said Quellan humble. The Damfair spat and strode out into the night. When he was gone, the crow's eye turned his smiling eye upon Victorian.
Lord Captain, have you no greeting for a brother long away? Nor you, Asher? How fares your lady mother?
Poorly, Asher said. Some man made her a widow.
Euron shrugged.
I have heard the storm god swept Balan to his death. Who is this man who slew him? Tell me his name, niece, so I might revenge myself on him.
Asher got to her feet.
You know his name as well as I. 3 years you were gone from us, and yet silence returns within a day of my lord father's death.
Do you accuse me?
Euron asked mildly.
Should I?
The sharpness in Asher's voice made Victorian frown. It was dangerous to speak so to the crow's eye, even when his smiling eye was shining with amusement.
Do I command the winds?
The crow's eye asked his pets.
No, your grace, said Orkwood of Orkmont.
No man commands the winds, said Jermyn Butler.
Would that you did, the red oarsman said. You would sail wherever you liked and never be becalmed.
There you have it from the mouths of three brave men, Euron said. The silence was at sea when Balon died. If you doubt an uncle's word, I give you leave to ask my crew.
A crew of mutes, aye. That would serve me well.
A husband would serve you well.
Euron turned to his followers again.
Torvald, I misremember. Do you have a wife?
Only the one.
Torvald Brontooth grinned. and showed how he had won his name.
"I am unwed,"
announced left-hand Lucas Cott.
"And for good reason," Asher said. "All women do despise the Cods as well. Don't look at me so mournful, Lucas. You still have your famous aunt."
She made a pumping motion with her fist. Cod cursed, till the crow's eye put a hand on his chest.
"Was that courteous, Asher? You have wounded Lucas to the quick."
"Easier than wounding him in the prick. I throw an axe as well as any man. But when the target is so small..."
"This girl forgets herself," snarled pinch-faced John Meyer.
"Balon let her believe she was a man."
"Your father made the same mistake with you," said Asher.
"Give her to me, Euron," suggested the red oarsman. "I'll spank her till her ass is as red as my hair."
"Come try," said Asher. "And hereafter we can call you the red eunuch."
A throwing axe was in her hand. She tossed it in the air and caught it deftly.
"Here is my husband, uncle. Any man who wants me shall take it up with him."
Victorian slammed his fist upon the table.
"I'll have no bloodshed here. Euron, take your pets and go."
"I had looked for a warmer welcome from you, brother. I am your elder and soon your rightful king."
Victorian's face darkened.
"When the Kingsmoot speaks, we shall see who wears the driftwood crown."
"Oh, on that we can agree."
Euron lifted two fingers to the patch that covered his left eye and took his leave. The others followed at his heels like mongrel dogs. Silence lingered behind him, till little Lenwood Tawney took up his fiddle. The wine and ale began to flow again, but several guests had lost their thirst. Eldred Cod slipped out, cradling his bloody hand. Then Will Humble, Hutto Harlaw, a goodly lot of good brothers.
"Nuncle,"
Asher put a hand upon his shoulder,
"walk with me, if you would."
Outside the tent, the wind was rising. Clouds raced across the moon's pale face. They looked a bit like galleys, stroking hard to ram. The stars were faint and few. All along the strand, the longships rested, tall masts rising like a forest from the surf. Victorian could hear their hulls creaking as they settled on the sand. He heard the keening of their lines, the sound of banners flapping. Beyond, in the deeper waters of the bay, larger ships bobbed at anchor, grim shadows wreathed in mist. They walked along the strand together, just above the surf, far from the camps and the cook fires.
Tell me, Nuncle, Asher said, why did Euron go away so suddenly? The crow's eye off went reaving. Never for so long. He took the silence east, a lengthy voyage. I asked why he went, not where.
When he did not answer, Asher said,
I was away when silence sailed. I had taken Blackwind round the arbor to the Stepstones, to steal a few trinkets from the Lyseni pirates. When I came home, Euron was gone, and your new wife was dead. She was only a salt wife.
He had not touched another woman since he gave her to the crabs.
I will need to take a wife when I am king, a true wife, to be my queen and bear me sons. A king must have an heir. My father refused to speak of her, said Asher. It does no good to speak of things no man can change.
He was wary of the subject.
I saw the reader's longship. It took all my charm to winkle him out of his book tower. She has the Harlaws, then.
Victorian's frown grew deeper.
You cannot hope to rule. You are a woman. Is that why I always lose the pissing contests?
Asher laughed.
Nuncle, it grieves me to say so, but you may be right. For 4 days and 4 nights I have been drinking with the captains and the kings, listening to what they say, and what they will not say. Mine own are with me, and many Harlaws. I have Triss Butley, too, and some few others. Not enough.
She kicked a rock and sent it splashing into the water between two longships.
I am of a mind to shout my nuncle's name. Which uncle?
He demanded.
You have three. Four, not clear me. I will place a driftwood crown upon your brow myself, if you will agree to share the rule.
Share the rule? How could that be? The woman's not making sense. Does she want to be my queen?
Victorin found himself looking at Asher in a way he had never looked at her before. He could feel his manhood beginning to stiffen.
She is Balon's daughter,
he reminded himself. He remembered her as a little girl throwing axes at a door. He crossed his arms against his chest.
The sea stone chair seats but one.
Then let mine uncle sit, Asher said. I will stand behind you to guard your back and whisper in your ear. No king can rule alone. Even when the dragon sat the Iron Throne, they had men to help them. The king's hands. Let me be your hand, uncle.
No king of the Isles had ever needed a hand, much less one who was a woman.
The captains and the kings would mock me in their cups. Why would you wish to be my hand?
To end this war, before this war ends us. We have won all that we are like to win, and stand to lose all just as quick, unless we make a peace. I have shown Lady Glover every courtesy, and she swears our lord will treat with me if we hand back Deepwood Mott, Torren Square, and Moat Cailin. She says the Northmen will cede us Sea Dragon Point and all the Stony Shore. Those lands are thinly peopled, yet 10 times larger than all the isles put together. An exchange of hostages will seal the pact, and each side will agree to make common cause with the other, should the Iron Throne...
Victorian chuckled.
This, Lady Glover, plays you for a fool, niece. Sea Dragon Point and Stony Shore are ours. Why hand back anything? Winterfell is burnt and broken, and the young wolf rots headless in the earth. We will have all the north, as your lord father dreamed.
When longships learn to row through trees, perhaps. A fisherman may hook a grey leviathan, but it will drag him down to death unless he cuts it loose. The north is too large for us to hold, and too full of northmen. Go back to your dolls, niece. Leave the winning of wars to warriors.
Victorin showed her his fists.
I have 2 hands. No man needs 3. I know a man who needs Hass Hollow, though. Hotho Humbach has offered me his daughter for my queen. If I take her, I will have the Harlaws.
That took the girl aback.
Lord Roderick rules House Harlaw. Roderick has no daughters, only books. Hotho will be his heir, and I will be the king.
Once he had said the words aloud, they sounded true.
The crow's eye has been too long away. Some men look larger at a distance,
Asher warned.
Walk amongst the cook fires if you dare, and listen. They are not telling tales of your strength, nor of my famous beauty. They talk only of the crow's eye, the far places he has seen, the women he has raped, and the men he's killed, the cities he has sacked, the way he burned Lord Tywin's fleet at Lannisport.
I burn the lion's fleet, Victorian insisted.
With mine own hands I flung the first torch onto his flagship. The crow's eye hatched a scheme.
Asher put her hand upon his arm.
And killed your wife as well, did he not?
Balon had commanded them not to speak of it, but Balon was dead.
He put a baby in her belly and made me do the killing. I would have killed him too. But Balin would have no kinslaying in his hall. He sent Euron into exile, never to return.
Ah, so long as Balin lived.
Victorian looked at his fists.
She gave me horns. I had no choice.
Had it been known, men would have laughed at me, as a crow's eye laughed when I confronted him. She came to me wet and willing.
He had boasted.
It seems Victorian is big everywhere, but where it matters.
But he could not tell her that.
I'm sorry for you, said Asher, and sorrier for her. But you leave me small choice but to claim the sea stone chair myself.
You cannot.
Your breath is yours to waste, woman.
It is,
she said, and left him. The Drowned Man. Only when his arms and legs were numb from the cold did Aaron Greyjoy struggle back to shore and don his robes again. He had run before the crow's eye as if he were still the weak thing he had been. But when the waves broke over his head, they reminded him once more that that man was dead.
"I was reborn from the sea, a harder man and stronger."
No mortal man could frighten him, no more than the darkness could, nor the bones of his soul, the grey and grisly bones of his soul. The sound of a door opening, the scream of a rusted iron hinge. The priest's robes crackled as he pulled them down, still stiff with salt from their last washing a fortnight past. The wool clung to his wet chest, drinking the brine that ran down from his hair. He filled his water-skin and slung it over his shoulder. As he strode across the strand, a drowned man returning from a call of nature stumbled into him in the darkness.
"Damfair," he murmured.
Aaron laid a hand upon his head, blessed him, and moved on. The ground rose beneath his feet, gently at first, then more steeply. When he felt scrub grass between his toes, he knew that he had left the strand behind. Slowly he climbed, listening to the waves.
"The sea is never weary. I must be as tireless."
On the crown of the hill, 44 monstrous stone ribs rose from the earth like trunks of great pale trees. The sight made Aaron's heart beat faster. Naga had been the first sea dragon, the mightiest ever to rise from the waves. She fed on krakens and leviathans, and drowned whole islands in her wrath. Yet the Grey King had slain her, and the drowned god had changed her bones to stone, so that men might never cease to wonder at the courage of the first of kings. Naga's ribs became the beams and pillars of his long haul, just as her jaws became his throne.
"For 1,007 he reigned here," Aaron recalled. "Here he took his mermaid wife and planned his wars against the storm god. From here he ruled both stone and salt, wearing robes of woven seaweed and a tall pale crown made from Naga's teeth.
But that was in the dawn of days when mighty men still dwelt on earth and sea. The hall had been warmed by Naga's living fire, which the Grey King had made his thrall. On its walls hung tapestries woven from silver seaweed most pleasing to the eyes. The Grey King's warriors had feasted on the bounty of the sea at a table in the shape of a great starfish, while seated upon thrones carved from mother-of-pearl.
"Gone, all the glory gone."
Men were smaller now. Their lives had grown short. The storm god drowned Naga's fire after the Grey King's death. The chairs and tapestries had been stolen, the roof and walls had rotted away. Even the Grey King's great throne of fangs had been swallowed by the sea. Only Naga's bones endured to remind the Ironborn of all the wonders that had been.
"It is enough," thought Aaron Greyjoy.
9 wide steps had been hewn from the stony hilltop. Behind rose the howling hills of Old Wyke, with mountains in the distance black and cruel. Aaron paused where the doors once stood, pulled the cork from his water-skin, took a swallow of salt water, and turned to face the sea.
"We were born from the sea, and to the sea we must return."
Even here he could hear the ceaseless rumble of the waves, and feel the power of the god who lurked below the waters. Aaron went to his knees.
"You have sent your people to me," he prayed. "They have left their halls and hovels, their castles and their keeps, and come here to Naga's bones from every fishing village and every hidden vale. Now grant to them the wisdom to know the true king when he stands before them, and the strength to shun the false."
All night he prayed, for when the god was in him, Aaron Greyjoy had no need of sleep, no more than the waves did, nor the fishes of the sea. Dark clouds ran before the wind, as the first light stole into the world. The black sky went grey as slate. The black sea turned grey-green. The black mountains of Great Wyke across the bay put on the blue-green hues of soldier pines. As colour stole back into the world, 100 banners lifted and began to flap. Aaron beheld the silver fish of Butley, the bloody moon of Winch, the dark green trees of Orkwood. He saw war horns and leviathans and scythes, and everywhere the krakens great and golden. Beneath them, thralls and salt wives began to move about, stirring coals into new life and gutting fish for the captains and the kings to break their fast. The dawnlight touched the stony strand, and he watched men wake from sleep, throwing aside their sealskin blankets as they called for their first horn of ale. "Drink deep," he thought, "for we have God's work to do today." The sea was stirring, too. The waves grew larger as the wind rose, sending plumes of spray to crash against the longships. "The drowned god wakes," thought Aaron. He could hear his voice welling from the depths of the sea. "I shall be with you here this day, my strong and faithful servant," the voice said. "No godless man will sit my sea-stone chair." It was there beneath the arch of Naga's ribs that his drowned men found him, standing tall and stern, with his long black hair blowing in the wind. "Is it time?" Ras asked. Aaron gave a nod and said, "It is. Go forth and sound the summons." The drowned men took up their driftwood cudgels and began to beat them one against the other as they walked back down the hill. Others joined them, and the clangor spread along the strand, such a fearful clacking and clattering it made, as if 100 trees were pommeling one another with their limbs. Kettle drums began to beat as well. Boom, 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 boom. A war horn bellowed, then another. Ow! Men left their fires to make their way toward the bones of the Grey King's Hall. Oarsmen, steersmen, sailmakers, shipwrights, the warriors with their axes, and the fishermen with their nets. Some had thralls to serve them, some had salt wives. Others who had sailed too often to the Greenlands were attended by maesters and singers and knights. The common men crowded together in a crescent around the base of the knoll, and the thralls, children and women, towards the rear. The captains and the kings made their way up the slopes. Aaron Damfair saw cheerful Siegfried Stone Tree, Andric the Unsmiling, the knight Sir Harris Harlaw. Lord Balor Blacktide, in his sable cloak, stood beside the stone house, in ragged sealskin. Victorian loomed above all of them, save Andric. His brother wore no helm, but elsewise he was all in armour, his kraken cloak hanging golden from his shoulders. "He shall be our king. What man could look on him and doubt it?" When the Damfair raised his bony hands, the kettle drums and the war horns fell silent. The drowned men lowered their cudgels, and all the voices stilled. Only the sound of the waves pounding remained, a roar no man could still. "We were born from the sea, and to the sea we all return," Aaron began, softly at first, so that men would strain to hear. "The storm god, in his wrath, plucked Balon from his castle and cast him down, yet now he feasts beneath the waves in the drowned god's watery halls." He lifted his eyes to the sky. "Balon is dead! The Iron King is dead!" "The king is dead!" his drowned men shouted. "Yet what is dead may never die, but rises again, harder and stronger," he reminded them.
Balon has fallen. Balon, my brother, who honored the old way and paid the iron price. Balon the brave, Balon the blessed, Balon twice crowned, who won us back our freedoms and our God. Balon is dead, but an iron king shall rise again to sit upon the sea-stone chair and rule the isles. A king shall rise, they answered. He shall rise. He shall. He must. Aaron's voice thundered like the waves. But who shall sit in Balon's place? Who shall rule these holy isles? Is he here among us now? The priest spread his hands wide. Who shall be king over us?
A seagull screamed back at him. The crowd began to stir like men waking from a dream. Each man looked at his neighbors to see which of them might presume to claim a crown.
The crow's eye was never patient, Aaron Damfair told himself. Mayhaps he will speak first. If so, it would be his undoing.
The captains and the kings had come a long way to this feast, and would not choose the first dish set before them.
They will want to taste and sample, a bite of him, a nibble of the other, until they find the one that suits them best.
Euron must have known that as well. He stood with his arms crossed amongst his mutes and monsters. Only the wind and the waves answered Aaron's call.
"The unborn must have a king," the priest insisted, after a long silence. "I ask again, who shall be king over us?"
"I will,"
came the answer from below. At once a ragged cry of, "Gilbert! Gilbert King!" went up. The captains gave way to let the claimant and his champions ascend the hill to stand at Aaron's side beneath the ribs of Nugga. This would-be king was a tall, spare lord with a melancholy visage, his lantern jaw shaved clean. His three champions took up the post two steps below him, bearing his sword and shield and banner. They shared a certain look with the tall lord, and Aaron took them for his sons. One unfurled his banner, a great black longship against a setting sun.
"I am Gilbert Farwind, Lord of the Lonely Light," the lord told the king's moot.
Aaron knew some Farwinds, a queer folk, who held lands on the westernmost shores of Great Wyke, and the scattered isles beyond, rock so small that most could support but a single household. Of those, the Lonely Light was the most distant, 8 days' sail to the northwest, among rookeries of seals and sea lions and the boundless grey oceans. The Farwinds there were even queerer than the rest. Some said they were skin-changers, unholy creatures who could take on the forms of sea-lions, walruses, even spotted whales, the wolves of the wild sea.
Lord Gilbert began to speak. He told of a wondrous land beyond the sunset sea, a land without winter or want, where death had no dominion.
"Make me your king, and I shall lead you there," he cried. "We will build 10,000 ships as Nymeria once did, and take sail with all our people to the land beyond the sunset. There every man shall be a king, and every wife a queen."
His eyes, Aaron saw, were now grey, now blue, as changeable as the seas.
"Mad eyes," he thought, "fool's eyes."
The vision he spoke of was doubtless a snare set by the storm god to lure the ironborn to destruction. The offerings that his men spilled out before the king's moot included sealskins and walrus tusks, arm rings made of whalebone, war horns banded in bronze. The captains looked and turned away, leaving lesser men to help themselves to the gifts. When the fool was done talking, and his champions began to shout his name, only the far winds took up the cry, and not even all of them. Soon enough the cries of, "Gilbert! Gilbert King!" faded away to silence.
The gull screamed loudly above them, and landed atop one of Nugga's ribs as the Lord of the Lonely Light made his way back down the hill. Aaron Damfair stepped forward once more.
"I ask you again, who shall be king over us?"
"Me,"
a deep voice boomed, and once more the crowd parted. The speaker was borne up the hill in a carved driftwood chair carried on the shoulders of his grandsons, a great ruin of a man, 20 stone heavy and 90 years old. He was cloaked in a white bear skin. His own hair was snow-white as well, and his huge beard covered him like a blanket from cheek to thighs, so it was hard to tell where the beard ended and the pelt began. Though his grandsons were great strapping men, they struggled with his weight up the steep stone steps. Before the Grey King's Hall they set him down, and three remained below him as his champions.
"Ah, 60 years ago this one might well have won the favour of the moot," Aaron thought, "but his hour is long past."
"Aye, me,"
the man roared from where he sat, in a voice as huge as he was.
"Why not? Who better? I am Eric Ironmaker, for them who's blind. Eric the Just, Eric Anvil Breaker. Show them my hammer, Thormor."
One of his champions lifted it up for all to see. A monstrous thing it was. Its haft wrapped in old leather, its head a brick of steel as large as a loaf of bread.
"I can't count how many hands I've smashed to pulp with that hammer," Eric said, "but might be some thief could tell you. I can't say how many heads I've crushed against my anvil neither, but there's some widows could. I can tell you all the deeds I've done in battle, but I'm 80, and won't live long enough to finish. If old is wise, no one is wiser than me. If big is strong, no one's stronger. You want a king with heirs, I've more than I can count. King Eric, aye, I like the sound of that. Come, say it with me. Eric, Eric, Anvil Breaker, Eric, King!"
As his grandsons took up the cry, their own sons came forward with chests upon their shoulders. When they upended them, at the base of the stone steps, a torrent of silver, bronze, and steel spilled forth. Arm rings, collars, daggers, dirks, and throwing axes. A few captains snatched up the choicest items and added their voices to the swelling chant. But no sooner had the cry begun to build than a woman's voice cut through it.
"Eric!"
Men moved aside to let her through. With one foot on the lower step, she said,
"Eric, stand up!"
A hush fell. The wind blew. Waves broke against the shore. Men murmured in each other's ears. Eric Ironmaker stared down at Asher Greyjoy.
"Go? Thrice damn girl? What did you say?"
"Stand up, Eric," she called. "Stand up, and I'll shout your name with all the rest. Stand up, and I'll be the first to follow you. You want a crown? Oi, stand up and take it."
Elsewhere in the press, the crow's eye laughed. Eric glared at him, the big man's hands closed tight around the arms of his driftwood throne. His face went red, then purple. His arms trembled with effort. Aaron could see a thick blue vein pulsing in his neck as he struggled to rise. For a moment it seemed as though he might do it, but the breath went out of him all at once, and he groaned and sank back onto his cushion. Euron laughed all the louder. The big man hung his head and grew old, all in the blink of an eye. His grandsons carried him back down the hill.
"Who shall rule the Ironborn?" Aaron Damfair called again. "Who shall be king over us?"
Men looked at one another. Some looked at Euron, some at Victarion, a few at Asher. Waves broke green and white against the longships. The gull cried once more, a raucous scream forlorn.
"Make your claim, Victorian," the Merlin called. "Let us have done with this mummer's farce."
"When I am ready," Victorian shouted back.
Aaron was pleased. "It's better if he waits."
The drum came next, another old man, though not so old as Eric. He climbed the hill on his own two legs, and on his hip rode Red Rain, his famous sword, forged of Valyrian steel in the days before the Doom. His champions were men of note, his son Dennis and Donal, both stout fighters, and between them Andric the Unsmiling, a giant of a man with arms as thick as trees. It spoke well of the drum that such a man would stand for him.
"Where is it written that our king must be a kraken?"
Drum began.
"What right has Fyke to rule us? Great Wyke is the largest isle, our law the richest, old Wyke the most holy. When the Black Lion was consumed by dragon fire, the Ironborn gave the primacy to Viking Greyjoy, aye, but as lord, not king."
It was a good beginning. Aaron heard shouts of approval, but they dwindled as the old man began to tell of the glories of the drums. He spoke of Dale the Dread, Rurin the Reaver, the hundred sons of Gormandrum, the old father. He drew Red Rain and told them how Hilmar Drum the Cunning had taken the blade from an armored knight with wits and a wooden cudgel. He spoke of ships long lost and battles 800 years forgotten, and the crowd grew restive. He spoke and spoke and then spoke still more. And when Drum's chests were thrown open, the captain saw the niggard's gifts he'd brought them.
"No throne was ever bought with bronze," the Damfair thought. The truth of that was plain to hear as the cries of "Drum! Drum! Dunstan King!" died away.
Aaron could feel a tightness in his belly, and it seemed to him that the waves were pounding louder than before.
"It is time," he thought, "it is time for Victorian to make his claim." "Who shall be king over us?"
the priest cried once more, but this time his fierce black eyes found his brother in the crowd.
"Nine sons were born from the loins of Kellan Greyjoy. One was mightier than all the rest, and knew no fear."
Victorian met his eyes and nodded. The captains parted before him as he climbed the steps.
"Brother, give me blessing," he said when he reached the top.
He knelt and bowed his head. Aaron uncorked his waterskin and poured a stream of seawater down upon his brow.
"What is dead can never die," the priest said,
and Victorian replied,
"But rises again, harder and stronger."
When Victorian rose, his champions arrayed themselves beneath him. Rafe the Limper, Red Rafe Stonehouse, and Newt the Barber, noted warriors all. Stonehouse bore the Greyjoy banner, the Golden Kraken, on a field as black as the midnight sea. As soon as it unfurled, the captains and the kings began to shout out the Lord Captain's name. Victorian waited until they quieted, then said,
"You all know me. If you want sweet words, look elsewhere. I have no singer's tongue. I have an axe, and I have these."
He raised his huge, mailed hands up to show them, and Newt the Barber displayed his axe, a fearsome piece of steel.
"I was a loyal brother," Victorian went on. "When Balin was wed, it was me he sent to Harlaw to bring him back his bride. I led his longships into many a battle and never lost but one. The first time Balin took a crown, it was me sailed into Lannisport to singe the lion's tail. The second time it was me he sent to skin the young wolf, should he come howling home. All you get from me is more of what you got from Balin. That's all I have to say."
With that, his champions began to shout, "Victorian, Victorian, Victorian King!" Below, his men were spilling out his chests, a cascade of silver, gold, and gems, a wealth of plunder. Captains scrambled to seize the richest pieces, shouting as they did so, "Victorian! Victorian! Victorian King!" Aaron watched the crow's eye. And will he speak now, or let the king's moot run its course? Orcwood of Orcmont was whispering in Euron's ear. But it was not Euron who put an end to the shouting. It was the woman. She put two fingers in her mouth and whistled, a sharp, shrill sound that cut through the tumult like a knife through curds.
"Nuncle! Nuncle!"
Bending, she snatched up a twisted golden collar and bounded up the steps. Newt seized her by the arm, and for half a heartbeat, Aaron was hopeful that his brother's champions would keep her silent. But Asher wrenched free of the barber's hand, and said something to Red Rafe that made him step aside. As she pushed past, the cheering died away. She was Balon Greyjoy's daughter, and the crowd was curious to hear her speak.
"It was good of you to bring such gifts to my queen's mood, Nuncle," she told Victorian. "But you need not have worn so much armor. I promise not to hurt you."
Asher turned to face the captains.
"There's no one braver than my Nuncle, and no one stronger, no one fiercer in a fight. And he counts to 10 as quick as any man. I've seen him do it. Though when he needs to go to 20, he does take off his boots."
That made them laugh.
"He has no sons, though. His wives keep dying. The crow's eye is his elder, and has a better claim."
"He does!" the Red Oarsman shouted from below.
"Aye, but my claim is better still."
Asher set the collar on her head at a jaunty angle, so the gold gleamed against her dark hair.
"Balin's brother cannot come before Balin's son."
"Balin's sons are dead," cried Rafe the Limper. "All I see is Balin's little daughter."
"Daughter?"
Asher slipped a hand beneath her jerkin.
"Oho, what's this? Shall I show you? Some of you have not seen one since they weaned you."
They laughed again.
"Teats on a king are a terrible thing. Is that the song? Rafe, you have me. I am a woman, though not an old woman like you. Rafe the Limper. Shouldn't that be Rafe the Limp?"
Asher drew a dirk from between her breasts.
"I'm a mother, too, and here is my suckling babe."
She held it up.
"And here, my champions."
They pushed past Victorian's three to stand below her. Carl the Maid, Tristopher Botley, and the knight Saharis Horlaw, whose sword Nightfall was as storied as Dunstan Drum's red rain.
"My uncle says you know him. You know me too." "I want to know you better," someone shouted. "Go home and know your wife," Asher shot back. "Nuncle says he'll give you more of what my father gave you." "Well, what was that? Gold and glory, some will say. Freedom, ever sweet. Aye, it's so, he gave us that. And widows, too. As Lord Blacktide will tell you, how many of you had your homes put to the torch when Robert came? How many had daughters raped and despoiled? Burnt towns and broken castles? My father gave you that. Defeat is what he gave you. Nuncle here will give you more. Not me. What will you give us?" said Lucas Codd. "Knitting?" "Aye, Lucas, I'll knit us all a kingdom."
She tossed her dirk from hand to hand.
"We need to take a lesson from the young wolf, who won every battle and lost all." "A wolf is not a kraken,"
Victorian objected.
"What the kraken grasps, it does not lose, be it longship or leviathan." "And what have we grasped, Nuncle? The north? What is that but leagues and leagues of leagues and leagues? Far from the sound of the sea, we have taken Moat Cailin, Deepwood Mott, Torren Square, even Winterfell. What have we to show for it?"
She beckoned, and her Black Wind men pushed forward chests of oak and iron on their shoulders.
"I give you the wealth of the stony shore,"
Asher said, as the first was upended. An avalanche of pebbles clattered forth, cascading down the steps, pebbles grey and black and white, worn smooth by the sea.
"I give you the riches of Deepwood,"
she said, as the second chest was opened. Pine combs came pouring out to roll and bounce down into the crowd.
"And last, the gold of Winterfell."
From the third chest came yellow turnips, round and hard and big as a man's head. They landed amidst the pebbles and the pine cones. Asher stabbed one with her dirk.
"Harmond Sharp," she shouted. "Your son Harrick died at Winterfell for this."
She pulled the turnip off her blade and tossed it to him.
"You have other sons, I think. If you trade their lives for turnips, shout my uncle's name." "And if I shout your name?"
Harmon demanded.
"What then?"
"Peace," said Asher. "Land, victory. I give you Sea Dragon Point and the stony shore, black earth and tall trees, and stones enough for every younger son to build a hall. We'll have the Northmen, too, as friends, to stand with us against the Iron Throne. Your choice is simple. Crown me for peace and victory, or crown my nuncle for more war and more defeat." She sheathed her dirk again.
"What will you have, Iron Men?"
"Victory!" shouted Roderick the Reader, his hands cupped about his mouth.
"Victory! And Asher! Asher!"
Lord Baelor Blacktide echoed.
"Asher, Queen!"
Asher's own crew took up the cry.
"Asher! Asher! Asher, Queen!"
They stamped their feet and shook their fists and yelled, as the Damfair listened in disbelief. She would leave her father's work undone. Yet Tristopher Butley was shouting for her, with many Harlaws, some good brothers, red-faced Lord Merlin, more men than the priest would ever have believed. For a woman? But others were holding their tongues, or muttering asides to their neighbours.
"No craven peace!"
Rafe the Limper roared. Red Rafe Stonehouse swirled the Greyjoy banner and bellowed,
"Victorian! Victorian! Victorian!"
Men began to shove at one another. Someone flung a pine cone at Asher's head. When she ducked, her makeshift crown fell off. For a moment it seemed to the priest as if he stood atop a giant anthill with a thousand ants in a boil at his feet. Shouts of "Asher!" and "Victorian!" surged back and forth, and it seemed as though some savage storm was about to engulf them all. "The storm god is amongst us," the priest thought, "sowing fury and discord." Sharp as a sword thrust, the sound of a horn split the air. Bright and baneful was its voice, a shivering hot scream that made a man's bones seem to thrum within him. The cry lingered in the damp sea air. All eyes turned toward the sound. It was one of Urin's mongrels winding the call, a monstrous man with a shaved head. Rings of gold and jade and jet glistened on his arms, and on his broad chest was tattooed some bird of prey, talons dripping with blood. The horn he blew was shiny black and twisted, and taller than a man, as he held it with both hands. It was bound about with bands of red gold and dark steel, incised with ancient Valyrian glyphs that seemed to glow redly as the sound swelled. It was a terrible sound, a wail of pain and fury that seemed to burn the ears. Aaron Damfair covered his and prayed for the drowned god to raise a mighty wave and smash the horn to silence. Yet still the shriek went on and on. "It is the horn of hell," he wanted to scream, though no man would have heard him. The cheeks of the tattooed man were so puffed out they looked about to burst, and the muscles in his chest twitched in a way that made it seem as if the bird was about to rip free of his flesh and take wing. And now the glyphs were burning brightly, every line and letter shimmering with white fire. On and on and on the sound went, echoing amongst the howling hills behind them and across the waters of Nagger's Cradle, to ring against the mountains of Great Wyke. On and on and on, until it filled the whole wet world. And when it seemed the sound would never end, it did. The hornblower's breath failed at last. He staggered and almost fell. The priest saw Orkwood of Orkmont catch him by one arm and hold him up, whilst left-hand Lucas Cod took the twisted black horn from his hands. A thin wisp of smoke was rising from the horn, and the priest saw blood and blisters upon the lips of the man who'd sounded it. The bird on his chest was bleeding too. Euron Greyjoy climbed the hill slowly, with every eye upon him. Above, the gull screamed and screamed again. "No godless man may sit the sea-stone chair," Aaron thought, but he knew that he must let his brother speak. His lips moved silently in prayer. Asher's champions stepped aside, and Victarion's as well. The priest took a step backward and put one hand upon the cold, rough stone of Naga's ribs. The crow's eye stopped atop the steps, at the doors of the Grey King's Hall, and turned his smiling eye upon the captains and the kings. But Aaron could feel his other eye as well, the one that he kept hidden. "Iron men," said Euron Greyjoy, "you have heard my horn, now hear my words. I am Balin's brother, Kellen's eldest living son. Lord Vicken's blood is in my veins, and the blood of the Elkraken. Yet I have sailed farther than any of them. Only one living kraken has never known defeat. Only one has never bent his knee. Only one has sailed to Ashai by the shadow, and seen wonders and terrors beyond imagining."
"If you like the shadow so well, go back there," called out pink-cheeked Carl the Maid, one of Asher's champions.
The crow's eye ignored him.
"My little brother would finish Balon's war and claim the north. My sweet niece would give us peace and pine cones."
His blue lips twisted in a smile.
"Asher prefers victory to defeat. Victarion wants a kingdom, not a few scant yards of earth. From me you shall have both. Crow's eye, you call me? Well, who has a keener eye than the crow? After every battle the crows come in, their hundreds and their thousands, to feast upon the fallen. A crow can espy death from afar, and I say that all of Westeros is dying. Those who follow me will feast unto the end of their days. We are the Ironborn, and once we were conquerors. Our writ ran everywhere the sound of the waves was heard. My brother would have you be content with the cold and dismal north. My niece with even less, but I shall give you Lannisport, Highgarden, the Arbor, Oldtown, the Riverlands and the Reach, the Kingswood and the Rainwood, Dawn and the Marshes, the Mountains of the Moon and the Vale of Erin, Tarth and the Stepstones. I say we take it all. I say we take Westeros."
He glanced at the priest.
"All for the greater glory of our drowned god, to be sure."
For half a heartbeat, even Erin was swept away by the boldness of his words. The priest had dreamed the same dream when first he'd seen the red comet in the sky.
"We shall sweep over the green lands with fire and sword, root out the seven gods of the Septons and the white trees of the Northmen."
"Crow's eye," Asher called, "did you leave your wits at Ashai? If we cannot hold the north, and we cannot, how can we win the whole of the seven kingdoms?" "Why, it has been done before. Did Balon teach his girl so little of the ways of war? Victarion, our brother's daughter, has never heard of Aegon the Conqueror?
it would seem.
Aegon, Victorian crossed his arms against his armored chest. What has the Conqueror to do with us?
I know as much of war as you do, Crozai, Asher said. Aegon Targaryen conquered Westeros with dragons.
And so shall we, Euron Greyjoy promised. That horn you heard I found amongst the smoking ruins that were Valyria, where no man has dared to walk but me. You heard its call and felt its power. It is a dragon horn, bound with bands of red gold and Valyria steel, graven with enchantments. The dragon lords of old sounded such horns before the doom devoured them. With this horn, Arnman, I can bind dragons to my will.
Asher laughed aloud.
A horn to bind goats to your will would be of more use, Crozai. There are no more dragons.
Again, girl, you are wrong. There are three, and I know where to find them. Surely that is worth a driftwood crown.
Euron!
Shouted left-hand Lucas Cod.
Euron! Crozai! Euron!
Cried the red oarsman. The mutes and mongrels from the silence threw open Euron's chests and spilled out his gifts before the captains and the kings. Then it was Hutho Harlaw, the priest's herd, as he filled his hands with gold. Gorol Goodbrother shouted out as well, and Eric Anvilbreaker.
Euron! Euron! Euron!
The crowd swelled, became a roar.
Euron! Euron! Crozai! Euron King!
It rolled up Nagas Hill like the storm god rattling the clouds.
Euron! 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 Euron!
Even a priest may doubt. Even a prophet may know terror. Aeron Damfair reached within himself for his god and discovered only silence. As a thousand voices shouted out his brother's name, all he could hear was a scream of a rusted iron hinge. Brienne. East of Maidenpool, the hills rose wild, and the pines closed in about them like a host of silent, grey-green soldiers. Nimble Dick said the coast road was the shortest way and the easiest, so they were seldom out of sight of the bay. The towns and villages along the shore grew smaller as they went, and less frequent. At nightfall they would seek an inn. Crab would share the common bed with other travellers, whilst Brienne took a room for her and Podrick.
Cheaper if we all shared the same bed, milady,
Nimble Dick would say.
You can lay your sword between us. Old Dick's a harmless feller, chivalrous as a knight, and honest as the day is long.
The days are growing shorter,
Brienne pointed out.
Well, that may be. If you don't trust me in the bed, I could just curl up on the floor, milady.
Not on my floor.
A man might think you don't trust me none.
Trust is earned, like gold.
As you say, milady, said Crab. But up north, where the road gives out, you'll need to trust Dick, then. If I wanted to take your gold at sword point, who's to stop me?
You don't own a sword. I do.
She shut the door between them and stood there listening, until she was certain he had moved away. However nimble he might be, Dick Crabbe was no Jaime Lannister, no Mad Mouse, not even a Humphrey Wagstaff. He was scrawny and ill-fed, his only armour a dinted half-helm spotted with rust. In place of a sword, he carried an old nicked dagger. So long as she was awake, he posed no danger to her.
Podrick, she said, there will come a time when there are no more inns to shelter us. I do not trust our guide. When we make camp, can you watch over me as I sleep?
Stay awake, my lady.
Sir, he thought. I have a sword. If Crab tries to hurt you, I could kill him.
No, she said sternly.
You are not to try and fight him. All I ask is that you watch him as I sleep, and wake me if he does anything suspicious. I wait quickly, you will find.
Crab showed his true colours the next day when they stopped to water the horses. Brian had to step behind some bushes to empty her bladder. As she was squatting,